Hadi bolu. Hadi bolu.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction. We are glad you're here with us. If you have been here for a while, we appreciate it very much. If you're new here, please like, follow, subscribe on whatever podcast platform you prefer. And if you'd like to become a member and get access to our exclusive content, such as the Skiff, our private members only show, go to humanreactionpod.com to find out how to do that.
And if you want to come chat with us, come join our Discord. We have a link to our Discord down below, and you get to share some news with us, chat with us, and you get to see some dank memes like this one right here. We got Donald Trump. He's asking the kid mowing the White House lawn, do you want to be Secretary of State? Which seems very relevant to what we're going to be talking about here, David.
Yes, sir.
Is that a crude joke about Marco Rubio being a landscaper?
There's an extra layer here I did not even consider.
I didn't think about that. Some people are saying it. I wouldn't say that.
He's Cuban, not Mexican, right?
Yes, that's correct. Right, well, yeah,
that's clear. So unlike AOC's pronouns, guys, you ruined it. Unlike AOC's pronouns in her Twitter bio, we are not quitting you, audience. We are sticking with it.
That did happen.
Yeah,
that did
happen. She's now a congresswoman too, not a congressperson. So,
oh really?
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Wow. Yeah. We are so back.
Nature is healing. You know that. All right. So we're gonna go through Trump staffing 3: The Empire Strikes Back. We got a really mixed bag this week. It should be very interesting. Talk a little bit about why this matters so much and getting into the future of America first and the implications of these roles. Some of those important picks for the future of the country happened this week, and we're going to dive into that and who these people are, try to get you a good sense of why these matter.
Sorry, before we get into all that, what is up with AOC changing her pronouns? Is the political calculus so bad right now that like they have to abandon these things and she's just like, yeah, getting rid of this nonsense?
You know, one of the topics I was thinking about discussing, because some really interesting stuff came out in the Wall Street Journal and New York Times this week about how the Democrats are reconciling the election internally. Mm-hmm. We talk a lot about, because we typically lean to the right, the interdynamics of America First and how that coalition is forming, the history of American rightism. We don't talk about the left as much from the inside out.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot going on there right now. There's a huge internal war. And I think a big part of that thread is the constituency of the kind of liberal elite that care about pronouns lost them the election is one of the interpretations, because it's so niche and because it loses the working class. I think we're going to see a lot more leftist, working class, populist type figures on the left moving away from that kind of rhetoric.
Who would have thought that Latinx just wouldn't take off?
Well, maybe that has something to do with it, right? I mean, yeah. maybe AOC wants to be a Latina again.
Well, AOC clearly has higher political ambitions. She is morphing into whatever she needs to be right now in order to do that. And she is working her way up the ladder in the moment. And she is also one of the most popular congresswomen, just like Twitter-wise. Mm-hmm. So I think she's
angling for more political influence.
Leaves, yeah,
yeah. I think that you have to do that if you are in any way a savvy political operator. I mean, only the like really out of touch elites on the left are doubling down on all the gender stuff and the cultural issues that have obviously driven such a wedge that it, like you said, lost in the election. So yeah. I think she's making a smart move doing that.
Yeah.
If you are a small business owner looking for exponential growth, you have to connect with Adam Thune at Intellectual Patriots. He will revolutionize your business game and help you get to the next level. Adam can streamline your business practices and advertising strategies to improve your bottom line. His expertise in data engineering means he can build you the systems you need to collect and analyze market data. His mission is to provide you with invaluable insights to fuel your success. From grant writing and business proposals to digital systems integrations, even AI management, Intellectual Patriots is a one-stop shop for cutting-edge solutions. Don't wait another second. Visit intelpatriots.com to learn more. That's intelpatriots.com. This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
But anyways, let's get into John Ratcliffe, the new CIA director. Who is this guy?
Well, he's
why does he matter?
He did have Tulsi's new role, which we'll get into in a minute, as DNI from 2021.
Director
2020,
of National Intelligence.
Yeah, from 2020 to 2021. He's kind of like very end of the Trump regime last time around. He's a Trump loyalist. Probably it's speculated that's why he got the job. And we have some interesting evidence of that, so of an X video here, Kyle, where he's defending Trump from his role within Congress, outside of Congress since then. So I think as far as for, you know, what role the CIA director plays, that's kind of an independent question from what America's First ambitions are, from why he got the role. So it's one of the variables and definitely something worth checking out.
All right, yeah, I got the video right here.
The approximately 50,000 text messages that I've seen with your personal beliefs like F Trump, stop Trump, impeach Trump, go ahead and confirm on the record that none of that occurred on an official FBI device or on official FBI time. Go ahead and do that.
Sir, no, they did. Many of them did.
Oh, they did. Okay, so
50,000, sir.
So really, no, I'll give you a chance at the end. So what you really meant to say was that when you said you never crossed that bright, inviolable line, what you meant to say was, except for 50,000 times, except for hundreds of times a day where I went back and forth expressing my personal opinions about effing Trump and stopping Trump and impeaching Trump on official FBI phones, on official FBI time. Other than that, you never crossed that line. I'm sure there are 13,000 FBI agents out there that are beaming with pride at how clearly you've drawn that line. Agent Strucker, you're starting to understand why some folks out there don't believe a word you say, and why it's especially troubling that you, of all people, are at the center of the three highest profile investigations in recent times that involved President Trump, and that you were in charge of an investigation investigating, gathering evidence against Donald Trump, a subject that you hated, that you wanted to F him, to stop him, to impeach him. And do you see why that might call into question everything you've touched on all of those investigations? Chairman, I'm done with this witness and I yield back.
And his name is John C.
Correct me if I'm wrong in that moment. That guy there, he was involved in that like text message love affair talking about like we're gonna fuck Trump up and all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
That was that situation?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And to be clear, he's not saying to be intimate with Trump. Like, that's
but he was intimate with the person he was having an affair with.
Yeah, yeah.
In those text messages.
Are we not saying phrasing anymore?
But it's easy. And this is the corruption at the FBI, FBI being in a, who supposedly reports to the president, actually undermining his presidency. Those are legitimate issues, right? So I'm not saying he's being a sycophant. That's why he got the job. But it's very clear that he's taken a defense of Trump very seriously in his role at DNI. For example, this is a great story. The New York Times ran a story on declassifying intel when he was at the DNI, specifically how controversial it was that he did so because it was unverified Russian disinformation for him to report on American intelligence about Russian intelligence when it came to Hillary Clinton's interfering with our election.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yep. Yeah.
So do you think we can expect more declassification from him in this role?
Maybe. That's one of the high points, right? One of the ambitions, I think, of America First is addressing overclassification. You have the declassification arguments around this JFK assassination and MLK. You have the UAP declassification thing. That's a big part of the Trump story now. I mean, I think despite him not wanting it to be, it still is. So if they are focused on as many things that have come up in the DNI role now and as CIA director, what they can do to give access to Congress and therefore the American people by proxy or to the American people directly by declassification, that's a good thing. And not necessarily something he will do, but something he could do in this role that we could be hopeful for.
Absolutely.
Is this role a bit of a demotion for him?
It kind of is because now he reports to Tulsi rather than being the well now yeah
because Tulsi's role is the one that like synthesizes all the intel of all the different organizations, and it's like one of 11 organizations or something like that, right?
Yeah, yeah. So
CIA is one of those.
Navy intelligence reports to her, CIA intelligence, all the intelligence, and this is all GWAT reforms after 9/11 to focus all intelligence going up to a single point. That's the DNI, Director of National Intelligence. So now he'll be reporting. So is it a demotion? Kind of, but he also, he went into private equity between the two during the Biden administration this last 4 years. So for him personally, no, he's getting back into the administration in a sense. So
interesting.
Yep. Yeah. So he's obviously a standard RNC hawk when it came to Ukraine, circa 2022. I want to play this clip because this clip, you could pretty much take the words from his mouth and put them into all of the other people we're going to talk about, because at this time throughout the Biden, they all had the same thing to say about Ukraine, despite how far it is from Trump's position on Ukraine, which is an interesting dynamic happening with these picks. I think people are probably underappreciating.
The time to provide Ukrainian support in terms of sanctions against Russia and weaponry to Ukraine is now, not after Russia invades. So, you know, I think President Zelensky, you know, would probably tell you, with friends like Joe Biden, who needs enemies?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible to me that under President Biden, you've got all of our adversaries acting up. I mean, there's Iran as well backing the Houthis, who are striking Abu Dhabi unbelievably. Let's talk about Iran for a moment, because we've had news there over the weekend. Secretary Blinken saying that the window is closing. Where is this headed? Do you think that Joe Biden is going to get the U.S. back into a nuclear deal?
Why is she yelling? And
Iran, the Iranians, won't even talk directly to the U.S., right?
Right. Now, this is headed in a terrible place, Maria. Look, we handed off a year ago peace in the Middle East on the heels of Abraham Accords, in part because Iran was poor, weaker, and less influential than they'd been in a long, long time. They were literally on the verge of bankruptcy. We had prosecuted their terrorist leaders to final justice, like Qasem Soleimani. And now you look at what's happening in one short year, how the tables have turned. As you've talked about, the Biden administration has literally begged Iran back to the negotiating table to try and rehabilitate the failed Iranian nuclear deal. And we're not even allowed to negotiate on our behalf. Our two biggest adversaries, China and Russia, are negotiating with Iran. And you don't need to take my word for how badly things are going. Joe Biden's own team members, negotiating teams, are leaving because they've characterized the approach as too soft. We're making too many concessions. Things like, you know, not only giving as much as $10 billion in cash to Iran, but lifting sanctions on the central bank, on the Iranian National Oil Company.
He's just going to keep going on. But yeah, that's, I think, a typical view of Republicans defending Trump at that time. And I think the distance there is interesting because Trump kind of started there in the beginning of the campaign, saying it never would have happened under his presidency. Kind of echoing that, I would have kept it from happening by empowering Ukraine more. But then as the election went on, he started saying NATO expansion is part of the cause of this, and kind of walking back to a more pro-peace position in a lot of this stuff. It isn't clear where Trump's really at on that, but to me, it became hopeful, at least, that he was at least willing to articulate American culpability in provoking the war in Ukraine.
That's interesting. What do you credit his shift in policy position on?
I don't know.
Libertarians.
Yeah, it could be trying to cultivate the libertarian vote, trying to cultivate a better, more clearly defined position from the Biden administration on this. Because if they're essentially the same, can he really count on that RFK Jr. vote?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's fair.
Although I think in general, Trump is much more of a peace-loving president. Sometimes we might disagree with avenues he takes to get there, and like there's going to be some things like that exists there, but in general it seems like that seems to be his vibe of what he wants to push. Like that seems to be his natural inclination, is always like, I want the killing to stop. I want that to stop, right? Yeah.
So. Well, I mean, he's not a military guy by trade, right? He's a business person. He likes to make deals. You know, business can only really be conducted well outside of a war zone, right? You know, so I feel like those two things are sort of at odds.
That seems to be kind of, he just wants everybody to have a good time. That kind of seems to be what it is.
Can't we just all get along and go play some golf?
Let's just build some casinos and some golf courses there. Let's do this. Let's stop fighting all each other.
Yeah.
But that seems to be more where his mindset is that kind of like economic growth prosperity idea.
And it's possible that Trump, along with a lot of these people, have evolved on this issue of Ukraine over time as reality has set. And even like Walls, who we covered last week, there's some new tweets out this recently saying him reconciling reality that they're not going to be able to push back Russia to the borders, that the Donbass is lost. And the best thing we could do from now is get the best deal we can for a future of stability and peace in the region.
Right.
So
that seems to be a theme that with all of these people where the foreign policy matters, like we'll get into Marco Rubio and Pete Hegseth and people like that. That seems to be a theme that I'm noticing in kind of like interviews I've seen recently. So I think we'll probably keep tackling that.
That they're all sort of walking back hawkishness.
Yeah.
At least on Ukraine. I mean, well, we still have, like, for example, this guy's a major China hawk. A quote from when he was D&I director in the Wall Street Journal. The People's Republic of China poses the greatest threat to America today and also the greatest threat to democracy and freedom around the world since World War II. So classic invoking of World War II and of our role in protecting democracy all over the world. Like, that kind of shows you, it is rhetoric, right? But it's rhetoric in compliance with the blob and the blob's architecture and the way they see the world. And now this is as an acting D&I director under Trump at the time. And obviously Trump, you know, hawkishness against China is very mainstream amongst most of this group. The question is just, what is that hawkishness and purpose of? U.S. global hegemony, saying that, you know, 10 miles off the coast of China, China has no right to project power to, versus a more like, no, they're a global adversary and we need to find a way to work with their rise that doesn't lead to nuclear war.
Right.
People from China, they love me.
Well, and it's also, there's a Cold War mentality that exists with China that is very mainstream right now. And I don't think that, it's one of those things where it's almost, I expect it in most of these picks. So it's not even something I'm like super disappointed in, right?
Yeah.
Right, yeah. I don't think, and we'll get back to this, but like, for example, he also says, quote, China believes the global order, that a global order without it at the top is a historical aberration. It aims to change that and reverse the spread of liberty around the world, right? And that last motivation piece is an interesting one right there, because it's like it's kind of invoking that China wants to dominate the world militarily and end, you know, democracy in Indonesia or something like that, which isn't a clear ambition of China. It's kind of like one they're imprinting on it so that they can better, you know, cast it as a villain. But that's super mainstream right now. We are the weird ones in that discussion globally, where we're saying, you know, actually China has a lot of enemies in the region and there's a lot of natural limits to its power projection, and we shouldn't take it as inevitable that China is going to have this incredible, like, global hegemonic rise on the scale of the USSR or America today, for all these reasons. That said, we probably would lose a war if we try to defend Taiwan, because it's 20 miles away from mainland China.
And they've got a huge military.
Yes.
Like, huge.
Yeah. And incredible military technology and things like that. That's not like what we've been dealing with in our Middle East wars or our covert ops in South America. These are very different kinds of conflicts.
Right.
And that's part of like the strategic realignment question as well. You have a lot of people who are saying, you know, we can't fight both Russia and China at the same time in a direct confrontation, much Russia, China, and Iran at the same time. So how do you prioritize these sorts of conflicts is at least a realist take, right? It's at least taking that step into, okay, we need a rational calculus of our power projection, rather than saying, oh, well, we're the U.S. military. We can literally fund everything forever and project power everywhere forever without consequence. It's just absurd. And it's kind of the collective psychosis in the D.C. blob that they're fighting against. So it, like, in that sense, it's a marginal gain.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, then we also have, what's this tweet here?
We have John Pompeo. He joined with John Pompeo.
Mike Pompeo.
John Ratcliffe. John Pompeo. Joined
John, Mike John Pompeo. Ratcliffe joined Mike Pompeo.
Yeah, in advocating for...
John Pompeo.
Do we have the Hooked on Phonics sound yet?
Yeah. It worked for me.
Did it?
I didn't even pronounce it wrong. I just gave him the wrong first name. Oh, I did pronounce it wrong.
You did pronounce it wrong.
You created a different person.
So do you remember the FISA fight last year?
Yeah.
Or back in the Trump administration.
For folks that don't remember, what went down?
Briefly. Last year we had this fight, and it happened throughout the Trump administration, which was an effort to restrain warrantless wiretaps by injecting more FISA accountability into the process of surveillance agencies surveilling the public. He joined with Mike Pompeo and others to try to stop FISA reform when Trump was president.
You know, it is interesting that this is the case, because in Trump's letter that he put out on Truth Social and X about the nomination of John Ratcliffe, he actually praised him for wanting to have FISA reform. Mm-hmm. So it is interesting, this dynamic.
Maybe that's a little bit of leading, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Saying, I'm really glad that you're on board with this.
Yeah,
John.
That's
thanks,
how
buddy.
I felt too. It's just like,
well, and maybe
we're
this
on
plays,
the same page, right?
Yeah, and maybe this plays into the adjustment of his role from DNI to CIA director, where Tulsi would be all about that, at least from what I would assume from
my
her positions.
Yeah, very much for FISA reform.
So he's putting him in a different, sort of more contained position, still a position of authority, but one where he would have less oversight over something like that.
And important still within his skill set.
Yeah.
Somebody that he trusts for the CIA, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. And somebody who could maybe, you know, apply a little bit of, let's just say, like, administrative guidance to someone like Tulsi Gabbard, who's coming in without a lot of this administrative experience leading the DNI. Like, having someone who was a former director in there could be a nice way to sort of distribute some of that know-how across what is relatively like kind of an inexperienced cabinet so far.
I think that's a white pill for it.
Yeah.
So we have a Secretary of Defense with Peter Hegseth,
who is a Fox News host.
And that's it.
That's all he is.
Pretty upset about that.
Weekend news.
Fox and Friends, Trump's favorite show. That's the online discourse of like, oh my God, he's terrible. He has no experience. All the neocons are freaking out about this pick, which is interesting. All the neocons are freaking out about this pick.
Probably a good sign.
Don't be suspicious.
But in the past, he was actually one of the people that was in line for VA director. What's the role called? VA? Is it VA director?
I'm not sure.
It's Secretary of the VA.
Secretary of
Veteran
VA.
Affairs.
Yep.
And that's an area that he has actually quite a bit of expertise, because he used to be the CEO of Concerned Veterans of America, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah. Which is a great sign for that. Now, he doesn't have direct control over a lot of those decisions, but it's a really good sign for the future of VA reform, because you have someone in authority in a high position who can then advocate for it. Yeah.
CVA, Concerned Veterans of America, is a nonprofit that is a major advocate for things like VA reform, military budget stuff, like reduction of military budget,
yep. And foreign
cleaning up
now.
The military, yeah, things like that.
Mm-hmm. So another one of his supports that is a big white pill is his support of, and we got this tweet from Liam here, of Defend the Guard.
Yes.
Where he's come out, we don't have to play the audio, but he's come out in support of it, which is huge. Having someone who and Tulsi does as well.
As does RFK.
And in that role of saying, states should play a role in the deployment of their National Guard especially when it is an undeclared war,
right.
Forcing Congress to actually engage in its war powers bottom up through nullification functionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is a really good development in more restrained foreign policy that forces Congress into its proper role of actually taking a stake in the future of our foreign policy.
Yeah, no, I think that's huge. And the fact that there are three cabinet appointments that support Defend the Guard is, I think, tremendous news for the potential success of that legislation, which came very close to passing in Montana. I believe also had a degree of success in Arizona. So, I mean, I think we're going to see a good legislative year for that policy position.
It'll probably be most Republican states in general will probably support it. That would be my guess. It's going to be a thing that's just incorporated into Republican policy.
Right. And one thing that you wonder with some of these appointments is, one of the big opponents of the passage of this legislation were the generals that were flown in to Montana to testify against Defend the Guard, saying it would weaken our military and it was a bad idea, threatening to pull funding from the state of Montana, you know, if they did pass it. I wonder if these appointees, assuming they're confirmed, will apply pressure to those generals to not obstruct the passage of this legislation if it comes up.
Well, a lot of those are guard generals too, though. Note that. I mean, that's the biggest vector for their push against Defend the Guard.
Sure.
How much they have ability to limit that, I don't know.
Sure.
But I would guess that at minimum be able to say, yeah, these generals are here, but we have the Secretary of Defense who supports this.
Right.
You know, that's a huge difference.
Absolutely.
In the battle and committee to make that sort of thing
yeah,
happen.
Yeah, it's a big counterbalance.
I don't know if it's going to go as far as Kyle saying with like becoming a broadly supported Republican position, but I think it becomes far easier to advocate for that position at that point.
Yeah, it's broadly supported America First position.
Yes, that's the right way to think about
it. In specific. Yes, old school Republican ideology, maybe not, but... As this new mind virus gets moved, a good mind virus, viruses can be good, gets spread through, I think it'll be very, very positive.
Political probiotics.
Yeah, political probiotics. This new, whatever this like big idea formation that's happening in this big tent model, like I think this is going to be a very accepted proposal of everybody that's in this tent that has formed underneath Trump.
Yeah. So where does he stand on foreign policy more generally with, you know, conflict in Ukraine, China, that sort of thing?
It's an interesting question, right? So we have some evidence. He did the same kind of talking points that Biden didn't act fast enough in 2022, that kind of era during the Biden administration. He does the same sort of gas station with the flag argument.
For Russia.
Basically, that's what Russia is. So now it's really important why that's such an important phrase for understanding the mental model behind your conceptualization of Russia. If you think that the effort to bring Ukraine into NATO, and this is the Mike Benz thesis, so I'm going to give him credit and also say it's on him if it's wrong. but I do think
someone's
a good argument.
Not us.
Yeah, yeah, I wouldn't say that. He's my boy. Right? But that bringing Ukraine into NATO was motivated by an effort to take the Burisma, which was owned by the public, into private equity, into the ownership of London finance and American finance. And that's the role that Hunter Biden was playing at Burisma on behalf of the intelligence community. If that's true, that's based upon the model that if you can deliver natural gas to Europe that outcompetes or flanks, like squeezes Russia's capability to raise money, you can then degrade their ability to project power.
I see.
Thus guaranteeing future hegemonic dominance of the United States over Russia.
Something I'll add to his foreign policy description. I listened to his interview with Sean Ryan from last week.
Yeah.
Sean Ryan, big podcaster. He has a lot of like military veterans and things like that on his show. He specifically said, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's close to this, is that he described his foreign policy as, I, like most people in this movement, am recovering from the blind neoconservatism of my youth.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
He said something along those lines.
Wow. Yeah.
Which is, that's a pretty big statement.
That is.
And I was actually very impressed with his general knowledge of the political factions and like the philosophical factions that exist within this realm. I came away quite bullish on him for this role. And one of the things that I think we're probably going to see is a lot of cleanup. I think we're going to end up seeing a lot of the bureaucracy, and it's like the philosophy of DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency under Elon and Vivek. We're going to see that philosophy being incorporated into everything that is kind of in his purview.
Yeah. Similar to that, we have this tweet from Dan Caldwell, who is now with Defense Priorities, formerly was also the CEO of CVA, saying, I have known Pete Hegseth for over a decade. Like a lot of GWAT vets, his foreign policy views evolved as the forever war dragged on and their costs soared. If you're calling him a neocon, you have no clue what you're talking about. And that seems sensible to me. That's a pattern I've seen again and again and again amongst the veteran community. Because and especially like you have to sympathize with the veterans who felt like they were put into Afghanistan or Iraq, were not given the support that they needed, and then saw people sacrifice for a mission that was so unclear. It makes sense. I mean, there's like videos circling the internet of him going around saying very hawkish things during the Bush administration. Well, I mean, he's literally fighting for his buddies on the ground to get support to accomplish a mission that was never that clear.
Yeah.
So what would you do? Well, I mean, I could understand that. And then as that drug on, as nothing changed in Washington, based upon the sacrifice of these soldiers, of course you would then head into like a, what are we doing this for?
Yeah.
Sort of direction. And those are powerful testimony to the real cost of this kind of reckless, hegemonic focused, not national interest focused, you know, foreign policy.
And I could see the withdrawal from Afghanistan being sort of a radicalizing moment for a lot of these figures as well, watching just the debacle that went down and how poorly that was handled. And ultimately, you know, the whole mission ended in failure at that point. And we gave a bunch of weapons to the Taliban and they're back in power. So it's like...
And millions of dollars.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and I think, aren't we still funding them?
A couple billion, wasn't it?
Aren't we sending money to the Taliban?
That was reported in the Sean Ryan podcast some time ago. I still don't... I got to do some research here. I still don't understand why. I mean, there are lots of programs for counterterrorism that buy off, you know, governments. So it could be one of those programs. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it is something that we blame. You should blame Bush for, right? Ultimately, the confusion between the Taliban and Al Qaeda. Right. We were there not to fight. I mean, Bush's mission was we're going to attack anyone who these people who conducted 9/11 and anyone who sheltered them. And the complexity there comes in is if you've read Scott Horton, right? If you're familiar with his book, oh, what am I thinking of here?
Enough
Already, Time to End the War in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. If you've read that book and you take a deep dive onto the early days of the war in Afghanistan to the degree that the Taliban, you know, tolerated Al-Qaeda, also tolerated when they were in the Mujahideen and we were funding them, offered to give up Osama bin Laden to us or to an ally that we could then expedite them to at various different stages of this, and then how the U.S. military under Bush, very specifically, was not allowed to capture Osama bin Laden when they could have, that you get, if you arrive at the conclusion, looking at the evidence of like, oh, the goal was to fight a war, not to win a war, I could understand where that would get there for a lot of those people where they're now saying, what did we do all this for?
Yeah.
And then with the Taliban coming back into power and a much more realistic, you know, not realist, hard-nosed, like, oh, they're the people there, so now we got to fund them sort of approach. I mean, it seems contradictory, but it's actually, that was the mission from the beginning.
Yeah.
And we couldn't get rid of the Taliban because what, we were going to fight that war for another 50 years, 60 years? 100 years? What are we going to do? I mean, if John McCain was saying we fight as long as we need to, we're going to keep them in Afghanistan, just like we keep troops in Japan.
Yeah.
So that's the forever war problem right there, right? So it's dealing with reality.
Yeah. Well, with this sort of recovering neocon frame, where does he stand on Iran?
That's a good question. We do have some evidence of his Iran hawkishness as a media figure. Now, it is a very different role from being a media figure commenting on Iran versus a media versus actually being in charge of U.S. foreign policy when it comes to that. But we do have a clip here if we want to play it.
I got it right here.
You have moments, Stephen. I happen to believe that we can't kick the can down the road any longer in trying to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear bomb. They used the killing of Soleimani as an excuse to say, we're scrapping the Iran deal. We all know they were scrapping it anyway. So what better time than now to say, we're starting the clock. You've got a week. You've got X amount of time before we start taking out your energy production facilities. We take out key infrastructure. We take out your missile sites. We take out nuclear development.
That is
we
not
take
a
out
popular
port
idea.
Capabilities. Or, you know what, take out a Quds headquarters while you're at it, if you want. I understand that's not a popular idea.
But I understand. I've been hearing that we believe that the Iranians are hiding missiles and weapons in some of these cultural sites, churches,
of course they do.
Mosques.
This is what Islamists do, is what they've done on the battlefield against folks like...
Yeah. Pretty clear.
Yeah.
Pretty
yeah.
clear position there. Yeah. Well...
And obviously the blog pushback was this person's unqualified, spectacularly unqualified, according to News Nation. Another one from Politico was, who the is this guy? this is an interesting pick on several levels. Still a lot of questions to be answered. How is he actually going to roll, you know, do this role?
An area that I want to just kind of bring out here, and it kind of echoes the Dan Caldwell tweet, is there's this instinct in a lot of people in kind of our realm, the libertarian realm, to just call everybody a neocon. anybody that's like even remotely hawkish on anything. And there's just kind of, and we got to be very careful of that, because like neoconservatism is a very specific philosophical thread that exists. And what seems to be happening right now in the America First movement is almost like a new philosophical thread that exists, where there's general like Cold War-ness that's happening with the China sphere, which Iran is kind of incorporated into the China sphere on there. But something that libertarians aren't appreciating enough in this America First philosophical thread of foreign policy is there's a lot of like wanting to clean up the military, make it more efficient, like get rid of all the bloat that exists there, get rid of the bureaucracy. There's even willingness to cut government spending as long as the military is like, it's like we have clear missions, everything's clean and efficient. You know, we know what we're doing. Like if we're going to use military action, it should be strategic with goals, not these like weird abstract, like, oh, we're fighting terrorism, you know, those types of things. And that's one of the areas that I think libertarians should be appreciating about this moment, is like the Overton window is in within this side, this camp has shifted so much more in our direction there. And like, there's, I think there's a reason for white pills to be had with some of these picks in that regard.
I completely agree. And I think, I mean, just shifting to the next pick here, who is also a white pill, Tulsi Gabbard, who we mentioned previously, has been nominated to head up as Director of National Intelligence. How do you guys feel about Tulsi? You excited?
Love Tulsi.
Oh, that's great.
Been following her since she became a congresswoman when she was still a Democrat. I used to always consider her the one good Democrat. Right. And then she's the one that got purged from the Democrats. And
Imagine that.
Well, because she's a Russian asset.
She is an Assad toady.
Yeah. Do you guys want to do that? I kind of want to.
Here, I'll pull
Barry Weiss. It's
I'll
right
pull
here.
The yeah. Barry Weiss. Yeah. So there's this old clip,
And it's getting brought back around. Right? They're literally copying this talking points from the Hillary Clinton campaign when Tulsi, you know, killed her,
figuratively
annihilated her on the debate stage.
Yeah,
on the issue of foreign policy.
Yeah. Yeah, and some context here. This is when she was running for president as a Democrat. Barry Weiss, who was on the Joe Rogan Experience, was this was before she was fired from the New York Times. She was still kind of in the New York Times blog.
No, this is after the New York Times.
It might have been like weeks after or something. It was around that time when she got fired then.
But okay. She got fired based upon her not supporting trans issues. It wasn't because
free speech stuff.
Yeah.
On college campuses.
Yeah, right.
She's somebody that is super hawkish, mm-hmm. Especially Israel, no matter what type of person. Mm-hmm. But this was her on the Joe Rogan Experience. And Joe Rogan is somebody that endorsed Tulsi, is a big friend of Tulsi Gabbard, mm-hmm. and this is Barry Weiss talking to him about it.
Kirsten Tulsi Gillibrand. Monstrous ideas.
Well, when she was 22, she had...
No, she's an Assad toady.
What does that mean?
She is
What's a toady?
I think that I used that word correctly. Jamie, can you check what toady means?
Like toeing the line? Is that what it means?
No, I think it's like a... T-O-A-D-I-E.
Love using words on the world's largest podcast that I don't
that
actually
mean?
Know.
I think it means what I think it means.
Very confident.
You're full of shit today.
Toady. Definition of toadies. A person who flatters or defers to others for self-serving reasons.
A sycophant.
So she's an Assad sycophant. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's known about her.
Like, what did she say that qualifies her?
I don't remember the details.
We probably should say that before we say that about her. We should probably read it, rather.
Well, I have read it.
No, I mean, we should right now.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Just so we know what she said.
Look up Tulsi Gabbard.
Look up Tulsi. I really enjoyed talking to her. I like her a lot.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I like talking to her.
Okay.
I like talking to her. I don't know about...
I think she's like the mother load of bad ideas.
Whoa.
I'm pretty positive about that.
But you can't mention
that,
any of them.
Especially on Assad. But maybe I'm wrong. I don't think I'm wrong.
Well, my take on her was that I think... As a person who's coming from the left, who's also a veteran and is very articulate and sensible and a woman, and in talking to her, we didn't get into Assad or any of those things, but talking to her about what she feels is wrong with the current administration and the way things are running and a direction she thinks things could go in, she had some very promising ideas. I didn't know about this.
But did she ever apologize for believing in conversion therapy?
I didn't even know she believed in conversion therapy.
Am I crazy?
Does Tulsi Gabbard believe in conversion therapy?
You know, there is an interesting point to be made there, because one of the things that has been hit on her that the left tried to throw at her several times now, and Joe, you know where I'm going.
I know exactly where you're going.
Is that she was involved in some Hindu sex cult in Hawaii that is like super anti-gay. This is what they called it, is this. And so I did, and this re-emerged into my timeline, into my feed in recent weeks. So I just like went and looked up this cult. No, it's like a yoga group that has, a YouTube channel. And
what do they believe? Calling it a sex cult is a really strange term for
Let me pull this up. Okay. I'm pulling up the Wikipedia.
It's all about round-the-clock sex. It's all,
but this is where it's coming from. So her aunt, when she started to take these more like going against the Democrat Party, like just bashed on her. And this is where everything is coming from, is from her aunt, is that she's like part of this. There's this guy, Chris Butler, who's like this cult leader in Hawaii that runs this yoga group. And it's called the Science of Identity Foundation. I looked up their YouTube page. It's just like, it's like a Hindu YouTube page that has like 30,000 followers.
Wow.
And then I looked into like their theology here. And one of the things in it was, let's see, it was, followers must practice vegetarianism and are not allowed to gamble, engage in sexual contact outside of marriage, or consume caffeine or intoxicants. So it's like the lamest sex cult ever.
I was like, calling it a sex cult is an absolute misnomer. It's like it's halfway between cult. Mormonism and Hinduism. Yeah. It's like, it couldn't be more square.
It's Mormonism plus stretching. Yeah. Is pretty much what it is.
But Butler, the guy who leads this, the criticisms are Butler's teachings include condemnation of homosexuality, hostility towards Islam, and skepticism of science, and that engaging in bisexual relations could lead to pedophilia and bestiality. That's what alleged. And then he even denies a bunch of these allegations. So,
wow.
But apparently somebody reported that he called men within the thing the F slur for gay.
Oh.
That's something that will get us censored. Uh-huh. And then women, the C word.
I see.
And she was a part of this group, apparently.
Well, I'm really excited to see who it is in the Senate that brings this up at her confirmation hearing, because this is going to be a hilarious conversation.
All right. So Christy Noem.
Yeah.
Is there anything else? Like, we're generally positive of the Tulsi Gabbard
pick.
Yes.
Yeah. I overall, especially for DNI, I mean, this is the person who was literally on a watch list during the Biden administration for what reason? Because of that. And real quick, Assad, reason why that's controversial, and reason what you call the Russia toady and Assad toady, was because Hillary Clinton was running a campaign based upon her actions as Secretary of State under the Obama administration, where she, and this is according to Obama, her war, the one that she got to do, think about that for a minute, but the one she got to do was Syria, which put us in direct confrontation, because Syria and Russia have a longstanding relationship, with Russian forces. And using literally Al-Qaeda, giving them weapons, Al-Qaeda of this area, like the branch, the local franchise, it's like McDonald's, but terrorism, giving them weapons to use against Russian assets in Syria, as if that was like, if that was a sensible foreign policy. And like I think when we covered it, I had described it as a seven-sided war. That's how complicated it was. Wow. And it's so ridiculous. It's such a terrible blob smear campaign against Tulsi Gabbard, who has more reason to identify with the institutions of America than Hillary Clinton does. Are you kidding me? I mean, she actually put her life on the line for this country, unlike Hillary Clinton, unlike Barry Weiss, unlike all these people who are criticizing her, saying that she's a betrayer of the American, you know, project, just because she doesn't want a war with Russia over who controls Syria. What are we talking about?
Yeah.
Well, and I just to add a little extra layer of context to that too, is one of the reasons where the Assad toady stuff comes from was, as Congresswoman, she went and met with Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And the neocons really didn't like this, because this was when all of the stuff was going down about, like, I think it might have been when Trump bombed the airstrip like there, which was like the only thing he basically did in Syria, and that was like his most presidential moment, according to the to the media, was bombing an airstrip in Syria. But and then in the debates during the presidential election, she destroyed Kamala Harris. And that's when Hillary Clinton came out and said that she's a Russian asset. Mm-hmm. And so that, so then the neocon blob all, and that's around the same time that this Barry Weiss clip came with.
I see.
So you kind of see she's from the New York Times. You have all that.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see the track that exists
didn't
there.
A bunch of Hillary's staff went to Kamala too, didn't they? When she was running the first time. So
yeah.
Kamala was Hillary 2.0.
Yeah.
So,
well, she was somebody that was very much selected. It was like her and two others that were selected as like, these are the young, fresh people. These are the next Obamas.
Mm-hmm. Go f yourself.
Yeah. Kristi Noem as Homeland Security Director. She shot her dog.
Well, next. She was almost a VP candidate. Then her autobiography dropped, her memoir, in which she describes this dog that she shot and a goat. Because she's such a badass. Like, that's what it was. It was meant to be like, I'm so badass.
I'm a powerful woman. Type
yeah,
of
right. Deal. If a dog is annoying, I go out and I shoot it. Yeah. And like, the universal response was like, what the fuck, you psychopath? What are you doing?
Yeah. The conversation I saw around that was like, well, it was mostly like absolute outrage. Because most people like don't live in a rural way. And there might be some justification for why she did it. Mm-hmm. You know, there can be justifications for that, but most people just have pets. They're not like ranching and stuff like that. So their perspective on that is like completely not where she was at all.
I've worked on a ranch. If a dog is annoying, you don't shoot it.
Well, if it's annoying.
No. Don't get me wrong. There are some people who might orientate that way, but I don't. That is not normal. That is way outside the norm.
Yes. It for sure is. Yeah. It for sure
it's
is.
That's how serial killers start.
Yeah. yeah. So nascent VP candidate before that dropped. And then I guess COVID is another one of the major, like, you know, notes that people are striking with her, saying, oh, she didn't ever shut down her state, that sort of thing.
She's widely considered the best COVID governor. And it's like her and then DeSantis, because she never locked down during COVID. She's considered that among Republican life.
Right. But wasn't that because her legislature wouldn't let her?
Well, that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. It's
some people are saying.
Some people are saying that.
It's a mixed bag. You know, I mean, like, it's unclear, especially because unlike DeSantis, she never was really out front. She wasn't on cable news defending this. She never really took the leadership cultural role that DeSantis did. That's why, and being from the Dakotas, she can get away with a lot more with less accountability. Florida, a lot of the media lives in Florida, is around Florida, that sort of stuff. It's a larger state, so it gets more focus.
Yeah.
So there's both sides of that. And additionally, the rules are different. Montana, for example, we had a governor who would have loved to shut us down at the time, but he knows there would have been a riot in the streets had he done that.
Come at me, bro.
Yeah. I mean, our stuff was so minimal because and all of our stuff came out with a, but you can still go outside. Because if you tell Montanans you can't go outside, people will have guns in the streets within days. Yeah, you know what I mean? So, like,
if you tell Montanans they can't go outside, that's the first thing they will do is go outside.
Exactly.
And just to say they can't.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's also these things, and it's just kind of like, There is this love affair that exists with Republicans and Kristi Noem, I think, because of the South Dakota dynamics. Like, she made a name for herself during that time. Mm-hmm. But I'm aware of several bills that she signed into law in South Dakota that makes me have this kind of like, did she just kind of ride this wave? And now, because like, she signed into law this central bank digital currency bill. Mm-hmm. There was like a bunch of like anti-Semitic hate speech bills that she signed into law.
Yep.
There's a bunch of things like that where I'm like, I don't know if I actually trust this woman. And although that being said, for Department of Homeland Security, it's like the policy positions that she signed into law aren't that big of a deal. So like, I don't really care that much about it, but it's just kind of like understanding who she is like, I'm a little bit more hesitant with her. And I think she's just somebody that rode the COVID wave into everybody loving her, right?
Yeah, so she kind of has this conservative reputation, but is it earned is the question, right? And there's a big difference between I'm good at running as a conservative, as a Tea Party type, versus actually being that person once you have power. And that's a very different calculus. And I think that applies to Kristi Noem in a lot of ways. It also applies to our next person, Marco Rubio, who was selected to Secretary of State.
Now, much to the chagrin of all the libertarians and America First Republicans.
Right. So just to talk about some of the roles here. So Homeland Security is like your preparedness, you know, making sure that our infrastructure is resistant to cyber attack. That's Homeland Security. Running the TSA contracts and running the TSA itself, that's Homeland Security. It's the person who is most in charge of like our the robustness of America's defense in the homeland. That sort of role is mostly administrative, not policy, but there are policy decisions within that I think people can be reasonably concerned about. With Marco Rubio, Secretary
Protect
of
your
State,
dogs.
You know, he basically came in on the Tea Party wave. Like, he was a Tea Party darling. At that time, you have to understand that the Tea Party didn't have a clear foreign policy, right? At Tea Party rallies, there'd be like Bush's like meme, like, do you miss me yet? That sort of thing was there. It's mostly a pushback against Obama than it is a cogent philosophy. And that's maybe what separates the Tea Party from America First in a lot of ways, which has actually formulated a more clear foreign policy point of view, a more clear governing way of looking at the world, other than we're spending too much and the deficit's bad and taxation's bad and these sorts of broad conservative worldview outlooks, which was more informative of the Tea Party.
Now,
what?
Like I said, I rearranged shit on the stream deck, so that's where the turn page button was.
Oh, got it.
Fuck.
No problem. So the upside is that Marco Rubio is not going to be charged with the DOD. So that's a win as far as I'm concerned.
Thank
right?
goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's more diplomatic relations.
Yeah.
Is and, what the Secretary of State role is.
And the downside of the diplomatic relationships is that this is where U.S. mercantilism comes into play in a lot of ways when it comes to putting pressure on behalf of economic interests. And Marco Rubio gave up the ghost on that a long time ago. He's become a major figure of the blob as far as I'm considered. You can count on him to be pro-life and to vote on tax reform, but in the Secretary of State role, there's so many better candidates out there for that. That's where it's most disappointing to me. I'm not looking at the DOD pick as like, oh, this is a disaster. Marco Rubio is probably the worst of that, in my opinion.
I have seen reports that he has similar to what we've said is a lot of people have changed their tone because of the realities on the ground in our foreign policy. And I've seen the reports that he kind of privately behind the scenes has shifted his positions in a lot of ways more towards the America First foreign policy dynamics, even though he's been maybe one of the most hawkish Republican senators that exists. And he's, you know, all of his committees are intelligence and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it kind of matters in his role because he's on those committees. So to me, I have a sense that this might be kind of a compromise pick that exists here. Mm-hmm. I think there's people that are way worse than Marco Rubio. Like, I'm seeing a lot of people that I like saying that he's no different than Liz Cheney. I'm not entirely convinced of that. I disagree with him mightily on foreign policy, but like, I feel that this might be a bit of a compromise. Like, I don't know if we would have gotten anybody better than Marco Rubio through the Senate.
Yeah.
For this confirmation, right?
Well, there's some other interesting.
And there's other interests too that exist in the big tent here. Like, there's a lot of people, especially when it comes to Middle Eastern Israel politics, that like this is their biggest issue, and these were big donors,
right,
for Donald Trump.
Right, the like, Adelsons, exactly. Yeah, gave $100 million. They expect something in return for that. This might be that something. Some of these picks might be, you know, some sort of negotiation there.
Also, major people like Bill Ackman that have crossed over from the Democrats and things like this, yeah, is one of his biggest issues,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So,
well, there's some other interesting like theories here, I guess, that I've been seeing floated around. I mean, talking about Rubio giving up his Senate seat, then DeSantis will have the opportunity to appoint someone into that seat. It seems like there's a bit of support rallying around Lara Trump,
yeah,
for that.
I've seen that too.
Which could be interesting.
She called on it. Like, she publicly stated it, that she wanted it.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Wow. Yep. So, and I mean, there are other factors here. I mean, Rubio obviously has to be elected to the Senate, but he can be fired from this position as well, right? So should things go haywire, or Trump, you know, maybe feel like he's not holding up his, you know, America First agenda in his role, he could be let go, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Marco has been, my understanding is he's been pretty loyal behind the scenes to Trump too. And I think that goes a long way as well. Like, it's been a long time since little Marco.
Yeah,
all the dick jokes that happened during the 2016 presidential primaries between, if people remember, there was the whole you know what guys with little hands say, and Marco was like saying that Trump has small hands, and there was all that stuff that
yeah,
was going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah,
and Trump was on the debate stage. There's no problem here.
Well, he was a finalist for VP as well, so it seems
he was in the running. He was like in the top four. Yeah.
So I out of that. you, well, we'll probably see out of this is obviously China hawkishness. Rubio is big on that. Cuba hawkishness and isolation of Cuba, Venezuela, those sorts of things. Rubio is definitely on the same side as Trump on that. So it makes sense in a lot of those levels. There isn't an insensibility to it. It's just a fear of if you had higher hopes, you could feel disappointed about that.
Yeah.
But enough of that. We got a bottle of white pills going forward. Let's dig in, dig in. All right. So it's been announced, and Vivek is in charge. We got a role for our boy, the tsunami.
How do we feel about it? Is this? Are you excited for this role for Vivek within the administration? I mean, it's not actually technically like
it's
real
an
department.
Outside third party department that is going to close down in 2026.
Yeah.
July 4th, 2026.
So it's an outside commission. What that means is that what it is when Trump comes into office, he directs the Office of Personnel Management and Budget to work with this group outside the government. That direction itself is within his executive privilege. So it isn't, it has no formal authority. But what it directs or asks the Office of Personnel Management and Budget to do, they have direct authority for these sort of things. Yeah, so if they come up with a set of recommendations and Office of Personnel Management and Budget help them cultivate, kind of create these recommendations and then execute on them as an EO or as then recommending it to go into law in some way. Those are the range of possibilities.
Would this be considered an NGO? Like Doge? Like are we just now setting up our own, like, is our side setting up our own NGOs for manipulation of government?
People have referred to Elon as the George Soros of the right.
That was stated at Mar-a-Lago in a thing, and he pumped his fist. <He did. laughs>
So interesting. I mean, obviously this is a very unknown variable, right? What would this will actually do? There isn't a lot of good parallels in the last 20 years of anything like this.
This is new.
The closest might be, I think it was called the Rose Commission during the Reagan administration, but we'll see. I mean, it is very encouraging. We do have like the debate of what they're going to focus on. Mm-hmm. Vivek was on Hannity, and I think the line of questioning from Hannity is the most insightful for, I think, what the blowback is likely to be, depending on the direction that they go for Doge.
Basically, keep your hands off defense spending.
Yeah.
Is where Hannity is at on it.
Pretty much.
Yeah, when publicly the goal for them is $2 trillion in cuts.
Which I'm not sure you can do without touching DOD.
Yeah.
That's pretty tough.
Well, interestingly, I mean, and I'd be curious what your guys' thoughts are on this. We haven't talked about RFK. He's up next. But the chart of the amount of budget that each of the departments has, Health and Human Services has a larger budget than the Department of Defense.
Yeah, so and this
it's like $2 trillion right there.
And this is the question of what Congress's role will be in synchronicity with the Trump administration and Doge, right? We've been funding the budget since before the creation of the iPad with continuing resolutions, basically saying, whatever you got, you now get this much more. So that sort of funding of the government has created the conditions we're at now. The executive can cut things unless the code says they will spend this much money. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You can only cut back to certain. Now, if we cut back to pre-2008 levels, we're doing amazing, right? That's beyond the nickel plan. That's beyond the penny plan and the other kind of how to cut budget on the margin for the federal government to get to a balanced budget someday future.
Yeah.
So that's my question. There's the code authority, what the executive is supposed to do to implement code, and then there's what they can do on top of that based upon CRs that have blown up the budget to what it is now.
I guess my big question about the potential efficacy of Doge is because it's sort of this non-governmental advisory commission that makes recommendations to the Office of Management and Budget, like can management and budget obstruct or just not take their recommendations?
Yeah.
They could just say, no thanks.
In theory, yeah. It depends on who he puts in charge of it and what their execution of it is.
Oh, and that's my next question is who leads it and then, you know, what's hiring like? I mean, obviously there's the whole idea that government employees like have, you know, better job security than tenured professors because they basically never get fired.
Right.
So like how does that all kind of play out in your head?
Additionally, there's the union regulations on firing of these guys. There's a whole bunch of barriers why the kind of permanent bureaucracy works by design. So your question being, if they obstruct, what are the tools at play? Well, it's like, for example, the executive order we covered earlier this week, we're more than once a week now, the rogue agency, rogue bureaucrat executive order. if you're taking a direct like instruction from your superior to implement something, that is something as a fireable offense, right? Is what they're interpreting that as. So in theory, you could get fired for that. I wouldn't suspect Office of Personnel Management would be the people who would be most likely to do that. Gotcha. I would rank them relatively low. Gotcha. Most of these are like the equivalent of your of the accountant at your work or your HR person.
So they're not so much activists; they're more like analysts, and you know, not inclined maybe to be as obstructionary.
Maybe less inclined would be the way to say it. I think. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, right.
Something I do want to add to this too is they launched their Twitter page last week, and within 24 hours they got 1.5 million followers. But they've also put out we are very grateful to the thousands of Americans who have expressed interest in helping us at Doge. We don't need more part-time idea generators. We need super high IQ small government revolutionaries willing to work 80 plus hours per week on unglamorous cost cutting. If that's you, DM this account with your CV. Elon and Vivek will review the top 1% of applicants.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, and also probably worth noting too is Dogecoin up 90% in the last week.
Imagine that. I nominate Dr. A, our friend Adam Thune from the Discord, and of course sponsor of the show, to apply. Why not, right?
Oh, he already has.
Oh, he has?
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Dope.
And thank you, Cheryl, for tagging me in that post. I don't think I could afford 80 hours a week right now. So it's not. I got a family. But it would be fun. So we also have RFK, or Health and Human Services. Really exciting in a lot of ways. This is one of the reasons he won, probably, was RFK's coming together with Make America Healthy Again. I don't know. There's not what else to say about it. We've talked about RFK a bit, but what would he do at Health and Human Services that would really make the difference is the question.
Man, I mean, I think the mandate is very clear that he needs to get to the bottom of COVID. And I have no doubt, given RFK's track record, that he will be thoroughly investigating Fauci, the CDC, the NIH, like all the stuff that went on there. This is the win of the year for sure. For sure. And for everybody who's out there calling him weird, right? It's like, I'm sorry, what?
For audio only listeners, I just pulled up an image of the previous HHS director and then RFK next to each other. And the health comparison is uncanny.
Mentally.
We'll just leave it at that.
I think like, really where RFK can make the biggest strides for the MAHA movement to me is understanding, getting to the bottom of how the food system has been captured by corporate interests that are allowed to put things in our food and water and cosmetic products and all that stuff that are just objectively bad. And I think that's where he can probably make the most gains. Personally, and I don't know what his authority would be in terms of like, can he ban things or can he instruct the FDA to ban things or whatever? And is that the approach that he'll take?
I mean, the FDA could ban things.
They
yeah.
should.
Oh, yeah. They have the statutory authority to do that. They do it all the time. The question is what and like how heavy of a hammer do you bring down? Like, it, what the blowback will be too. The political calculus of if you ban seed oils, right? Is that more like his vaccine point of view or is it something else, right? Like how to separate how he actually views what government's role should be in this area is part of the question.
For sure. Well, and I mean, on the vaccine thing, I don't think that RFK advocates for banning vaccines.
Exactly.
I mean, he's said as much. He's not anti-vaccine. He just wants to provide medical choice to people.
More transparency. There's things with the double blind tests, things right. like that he's right. offering.
So the right. question is if business wants to use a seed oil to make their fries and not beef tallow for whatever calculus they're making, is he going to ban seed oils in that sense? Or is it going to be more like his vaccine point of view, which is we need freedom of choice.
Right.
Businesses have that choice.
I think that's the approach he'll take. And I think if he is able to apply pressure to government subsidies of some of these crops like soy and canola and whatever else that's being grown, that's being given money to be offered more cheaply to the American public. If that is allowed to equilibrate in the market with other potential fats like tallow or whatever, mm-hmm. I don't think you'll have to ban it because economically it won't make as much sense. And if consumers are demanding a different product and it's at price parity or it's even maybe a little cheaper to go with tallow or something else, they will.
Right. If the Health Human Service is putting out canola oil and these sorts of bad for people, we're not going to ban it, but we're going to tell you you shouldn't put this in your food.
or require you to put a warning on the label of your burger or your fries that say this contains seed oils or something like, I mean, yeah.
And then you have that separation. Okay, labeling is another one, and I'm pretty sure the FDA has pretty broad authority on determining label.
Yeah.
The other side of that is the farm bill and who's Secretary of Ag.
Mm-hmm.
And we read the Secretary of Ag announcement. That was radical. That, I mean, if that guy's confirmed.
Thomas Massey?
Yeah. And
well,
and
the other guy, Joel Saladin.
Saladin.
Yeah.
Joel Saladin.
I mean, I feel confident Massey's okay with removing subsidies out of the farm bill. And if that guy's an advisor and he can be a defender of that point of view, popularly, that's huge. That's a big deal, right? And so that parity of congressional action on the farm bill, which is an annual bill, to reduce or realign these subsidies, that could be huge. I mean, if you're subsidizing regenerative agriculture rather than just corn, would that have better outcomes?
Just don't subsidize anything.
Well, yeah, I know, view. But when my brother.
Look, that's
with you, but that's how it works.
I get it.
I've been in the room. They're all like, what are we going to do with the farm bill this year? And I'm like, are we going to like reduce subsidies? We have a Republican governor or a Republican Senate, House, and presidency. And I was like, are you insane? We can't do that. The farmers got to have something. They're based their entire business model for three generations on subsidies. You can't change that. So,
well, that would be interesting to see how they could approach that and how Doge might look at that and come up with some alternative solutions.
And I don't think you can undervalue the synergy there. That is actually a tremendous opportunity with real outcomes that could help Americans and operating in the reality that we're at, where we have a farm bill that's going to come out, and the separation between the farm bill and CHIP and all the actual value there as synergies with Massey and then RFK in this role.
CHIP being...
Sorry. CHIP is your subsidy for states to then fund like nutrition programs for children.
Gotcha.
And the poor.
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot of potential good that can come from that. It's probably what I'm most excited about for this administration personally. Yeah. But I think that's great.
We know you're a health nut, Joe.
A little.
Well, and I'll actually say too is RFK has persuaded a lot of people towards his side that I would have thought completely unpersuadable. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that for the last 2 years have been telling me how awful RFK is. He's basically a socialist, all this stuff. Like a lot of people in the kind of the conservative libertarian space and are now kind of like, in the last like 2 months.
And I think RFK has rebranded himself somewhat too. He's moved in a more libertarian direction in a lot of ways as well.
He's an LP member.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. All right.
And actually kind of speaking about that in a sense is one of Trump's big promises that he made to both the libertarians and also to the Bitcoin crowd was that he was going to fire Gary Gensler of the SEC. And Gary Gensler yesterday put out his quasi-resignation letter.
Oh, really?
He put out this, we have remarkable staff and we protected all these people, blah, blah, blah. He did his whole thing.
You're full of shit today.
He puts out a statement that's essentially suggesting his resignation. It wasn't an official resignation, but it's like the writing's on the wall. So that's really good news. He's undercutting Trump. We can't say you're fired because he's just going to leave.
Ouch.
We don't know who...
take that, Trump. You can't fire me. I quit.
Basically. But you can't... we don't know who the new SEC guy is going to be, but everything's looking very positive. Markets, obviously, extremely positive. Bitcoin went to $93,000 this week. It's now kind of come back down a little bit. But and then minutes after this letter went out, 18 U.S. states filed a lawsuit against the SEC and Gary Gensler for massive government overreach and trying to completely stamp out the crypto industry. Montana was one of these. Austin Knutson was on the was on there. I saw our friends at Frontier Institute tweeting this out too. After I told them that this was happening.
Nice.
I love you, Kendall. So super dope to see that. But then also some bad news that's happening in this realm is Shane Copeland, the CEO of Polymarket. Polymarket kind of got a massive name for being the prediction market that everybody was looking at when it came to polling. And everybody's like, Polymarket got it right. Polling's kind of getting it wrong. Like that kind of narrative's going on. He got raided by the FBI a couple days ago and his phone taken. And I actually got a tweet here. I didn't pull this other tweet, but he tweeted out new phone who dis a few hours after this. But he tweeted out, it's discouraging that the current administration would seek a last-ditch effort to go after companies they deem to be associated with political opponents. We are deeply committed to being nonpartisan, and today is no different, but the incumbents should do some self-reflecting and recognize that taking a more pro-business, pro-startup approach may be what would have changed their fate and this election. Polymarket has provided value to tens of millions of people this election cycle while causing harm to nobody. We're deeply proud of that. I'm also proud to say that the future of America, and in particular American entrepreneurship, has never been brighter. In the face of adversity, we build Eagle. Eagle emoji. Elon Musk tweeted Indeed underneath it, but
So the rationale here is Polymarket obviously had some whale jump in kind of before the consensus was that Donald Trump was going to win, signaling a Donald Trump win. So it was kind of a wag the dog sort of operation that was accused of by a lot of corporate press on Polymarket.
It was Toad on our live stream. On our live stream,
dude, he bet on Kamala. Come on.
For those that weren't there, this was late into our election night live stream. We had Toad on from Tower Gang, who was pretty funny.
Funny. That was hilarious.
Yeah, he was hilarious. Me, but he was sitting there betting on the election, and he went on the American competitor to Polymarket. Polymarket can't operate in the United States.
Right.
Like they can't offer services because the SEC and the CFTC, because of regulations, because you are trading a market of cryptocurrency, in order to make these bets. It's not like you're betting on like sports betting. It's like, you know, this is an actual market. You're buying things at this level and then you can sell your positions and things like that. In order to use it in America, you're geo-blocked if you're using it in America. So people that in America use VPNs. And one of the things that kind of happened in this is something that I've been paying deep attention to, and I've blocked a lot of people on Twitter because of this, is there appears to be several people, the crypto industry at large, probably about 90% of the crypto industry was very in favor of Donald Trump. But some of these like holdouts that are Kamala people, and they're trying to defend Kamala is going to be great on crypto, all this stuff. and the people that just have total Trump derangement syndrome, apparently a bunch of them. And I saw leaked DMs. I'm not going to say any names right now. Like, I'm just kind of like, I know some people that were involved in this. And I saw DMs were working with journalists and people at the CFTC trying to expose American whales that were betting on Polymarket because Polymarket can't go to American citizens. Mm-hmm. And there appears to be an effort to exist to shut down Polymarket before the election because of how much sway it was having.
Oh, wow.
In the election. I have preemptively now blocked several people that I was mutuals with that seem to be associated with this.
Interesting.
But that is the dynamics that were happening.
You got to keep those people at bay so you don't get banned again.
Yeah. Well, but it's just one of these things where there's a lot of people in this industry where just like, there's people within this industry that were being informants on this thing, on something that's just like such a zero harm nonsense that you can't use this in America.
Totally. Right? I mean, I could see the argument that it's not zero harm if you're on the left and you're seeing, you know, highly capitalized individuals come and dump a bunch of money on this market to try to make it look like Trump's winning by more than he is. Although I'd be curious to know, I mean, throughout most of the pre-election period, you know, what were his numbers at? I mean, they were like relatively close, you know, it was like 65, 45, somewhere in there.
Like it's about a month out, right? Right around when absentee ballots dropped. There's this huge boost to the Trump side of that without any seeming landscape change. But what's funny here is if they would have lost, they would have lost all that money, right? If Kamala would have won, Polymarket would have given them, taken their money and given it to somebody else. So like
totally.
I don't understand what there's no principled objection here. It's just hard nosed politics, right? Trying to hurt your enemies.
I suppose, I mean, your wag the dog argument, I think is the one, right? Mm-hmm. That's the one that they could make where, oh, they influenced the election by, you know, making people think Kamala was losing by a bunch. So they didn't go vote for her.
Well, yeah. But would manipulated polling from the New York Times that showed Kamala was up in some of these states that she lost by a lot?
Yeah, that's fair.
Is that subject to U.S. government pressure.
Right.
And much less if it's a foreign company. If The Guardian did something that made it look like Kamala was going to win, are they liable? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, and here's also the thing is, too, is you can bet and participate in this market anonymously. All you need is a MetaMask wallet in order to sign into Polymarket, and it'll geo-block you if you're a United States citizen. So all you really need is a VPN. You can just say you're in Ireland or something like that, and you can be in here. But like, you don't have to sign up your email address or anything. Like, you can be anonymous on Polymarket, and that's, I think, one of the areas where people are very. Like, there's not a KYC mechanism, a know your customer mechanism that exists there.
To be clear, we're not advising anybody to skirt US law.
I'm just saying how it's done. Some people are saying it. I don't know. I would never say it.
NFA, DYOR, et cetera, et cetera.
And to the point where, like, I was just talking with somebody who's pretty big in the crypto industry, who's out in Southeast Asia a few days ago, and he is refusing to come back to America until Trump's in office. So like there's a lot of concerns about this backlash that is existing because the Democrats have been the ones running the Operation Choke Point 2.0 and trying to squeeze all these people out. And so it's just like just a lot of people just be safe until Trump's in office because right now the backlash is very real.
Yeah. Well, if Trump, I mean, if it was legislated, it would be different. But if Trump does executive operations, executive orders, whatever, to make crypto more established in the U.S., those things can be rolled back by the next administration if it's not a crypto-friendly administration, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they might be safe in America for 4 years, but things might turn around again in the future.
But it's becoming so institutionalized right now. Like, I think within the next 4 years, crypto is going to be way more mainstream in a sense, just because all the major institutions, the banks and everything like that are beginning to adopt it.
And if they build infrastructure, then they're going to be incentivized to resist an administration that is overtly hawkish, let's say, against crypto.
I think that, and this goes beyond crypto, I think in general, we're just going to be seeing a bit of a golden age of technological progress over the next, we're going to see the beginnings of it. Like all the beginning pieces are going to be put into place for massive technological process, and crypto is one variable in that massive change, I think, right now.
It's cool. More punishing if you change an established industry versus a startup industry. Mm-hmm. And then second to that, there's no reason Trump can't request a crypto bill from Congress.
True.
Right. And there's a lot of incentives to do that because of the right wing's ambition to capture tech. So the more they can capture tech, the better they can do by, you know, giving them actual results that are permanent.
Yeah.
And one last thing, we don't have to go into this too deeply. Like, we already have the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve. Mm-hmm. We got tons of friendly senators and congressmen. The crypto industry as a whole has for the first time really put in massive lobbying efforts. And mm-hmm. there's like massive PACs and advocacy outlets that exist. And it's becoming more incorporated into the think tank world. So this industry as a whole is here to stay now. And it's like now that we finally have our first like friendly administration, as well as Republicans in office who are the most friendly towards it, it's just everything's wins from here, it seems like. So, but yeah, let's move on. Our last pick is Secretary of the Interior goes to Doug Burgum. He was the governor of North Dakota. To be honest, I feel like this is a pretty solid pick.
Dakotas are crushing it.
They are.
Yeah. I was impressed with his economic knowledge during the election because he did run for president.
He did.
People forgot that. He was up there. He was one of these guys where I was like, you know, I kind of like him, but
he's not super presidential.
He's not. He doesn't have the it factor for a presidential pick.
Yeah.
He's a billionaire. He sold his company to Microsoft, where then he went and became the senior vice president of one of the major divisions of Microsoft, like Microsoft 365 or something. I can't remember. I also know that he's very in the tech world. I know I was listening to Mark Andreessen and Ben Horowitz, the A16Z podcast. Like, they're the two of the biggest venture capitalists when it comes to tech in the country, in the world, really. And Mark Andreessen, who I'm a huge fan of, was saying that Doug Burgum's basically his best friend. So I think that's also a positive development there.
Yeah. So picking a guy from the Dakotas who understands Western issues, the Secretary of Interior has the most effect out west, everything west of the Mississippi. We're talking public lands, natural resources, Native American affairs. That's all interior. So a person from there who understands those issues, I don't know enough about him personally to see what his if he has like reform-minded things about that, but his policy positions there are more likely to be better than not. And I would say, you know, just first glance, it looks like a positive pick.
Yeah, my understanding is that he's done exceptionally well as governor, especially on the economic end. And when we're talking about North Dakota, we're talking about natural resources.
For sure.
Which is, and this is one of the major things for the Trump administration is natural resources, energy.
Drill, baby, drill.
Drill, baby, drill, combat inflation with drilling.
Talking Keystone, we're talking the Bakken, we're talking about Anwar, we're talking about all the major energy policy stuff. That all happens. The biggest impact of that is on federal lands and state lands, and Interior plays a direct role in that.
Yeah. So overall, I think solid pick. See, honestly, it's probably one of the best picks that people aren't really going to even care about that much.
Yeah.
Just because it's not like a sexy position.
Yeah. But it's super important when it comes to the energy abundance agenda that Trump has articulated. Yeah. So I think that's the real win there. So stepping back, the big picture from here is we are getting a lot of signal and counter signal of the interpretation of this as a whole. We have the biggest roles filled, not all the roles, but the biggest roles. How should people interpret this? So we have Thaddeus Russell, for example. He tweeted out his reaction, which I think is pretty indicative of, I think, that point of view. You voted for Trump and you're getting the Bush administration, which I think is that's a non-typical sort of take from the more radical, not libertarian camp, but just radical anti-establishment camp. You have Robbie Suave. We're getting libertarianism in the sheets and neoconservatism in the streets, which is,
I think, funny.
But you're in a, you know, how, and then Dave Smith was on Unheard. He basically said that this is just a whole bunch of bad picks except for Tulsi. How should people, stepping back, kind of assess this overall?
I think there's too much blackpilling. I think there's areas to be concerned, but if this isn't a massive step and an improvement from 2016, I don't know what is. Like, I don't know what you could have expected here.
And 2004 and 2000 and 2012.
Yeah, but even just an improvement from previous Trump, it's a massive improvement. But then when we're looking at even previous other administrations, like, I don't know, like, this is great. And it's one of these things where it's like I said when we were talking about Pete Hegseth to me, there's a different philosophical strand on the foreign policy stuff that's different from neoconservatism. There's areas to be concerned for libertarians on the hawkishness, blah, 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 all that stuff. But I don't think that we are going to get perfect libertarian wins there.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think I'm seeing a level of perhaps naivete or maybe just like idealism, which is totally unsurprising coming from libertarians that expected this entire cabinet to be revolutionaries. I think that we should be excited about the positions that we got, you know, the RFKs, Tulsi Gabbard's, even Pete Hegseth to a degree, Thomas Massey, if he comes on at Ag, Vivek and Doge. I mean, there's so many wins here to expect to have just like swept the whole board. I think is just not realistic. And stepping back and looking at like how the chips have fallen here, assuming everyone gets confirmed by the Senate, it's a really, really great position to be in.
I think the strategy should be, at least in part, is marginalism, right? You get the next thing you can get, the next best thing you can get on the margin, rather than we get everything we want in the first go. If you look at the change between here and every other administration we've had since Reagan, these are good things, right?
Totally.
Overall. And there's also a resistance I see amongst anti-establishment people of all stripes to not celebrate your wins.
Totally.
And that creates a culture, like your internal culture of nihilism and despair, and you just can never win because you never get perfect. That is the wrong way to think about it. You should think about it in terms of what is the marginal win we got this time and how do we build on that in the future?
Right.
And there's nothing, I see this as very promising, although not a slam dunk, but very promising on so many levels. If you overweigh Israel and China in your foreign policy calculus, saying, I really expected a different Israel-China policy from the Biden administration, I don't know what you were consuming. You know, what were you looking at in the last 2 years?
Right.
Because broadly, the change there hasn't been what it's been on Ukraine. I personally think Ukraine, as much as I sympathize with the Palestinian plight, and I totally get that, and I don't want to fund that, as much as I'm there with these people who express this concern right now, we are this close to a nuclear war with Russia. That right now, as far as I'm concerned, a win there is a tremendous difference that we should celebrate in this moment.
Yeah.
Given that we have Ukrainian skeptics in a lot of these Ukraine war skeptics in a lot of these roles, and people who are more likely to reinforce in the court dynamic, right? In the we're all sitting at a big table and Trump's at the head dynamic, and we're discussing what we should do about Ukraine and a deal on the table. There's going to be far more voices there that are anti-blob than any other time that I've seen since I've been alive.
Yeah. Yeah.
So why wouldn't you take that moment and maintain that position of positivity and say, we need to own this win and say, this is good. One more thing than that. If you're a non-interventionist, meaning I want the Ron Paulian ideal, and the steps to get there are probably in order to take all the institutions and move them in that direction, you're not going to get there in one leap. The next step to there is probably realism, and then restraint past that is restraint, and then you get to non-interventionism. So we have to own the realist moment next. That's the future here, where we can say it's impractical for the United States to do all these things. So how do we prioritize?
Yeah.
Once you get that space and you say, okay, it's now we now have a priority. Now, how do we restrain our impulse to use violence to solve these problems? And can we find another way using other tools? And then lastly, we get to the point of our job is not to police the world and to globally dominate everything. Our job is actually to ensure the future prosperity and peace of Americans. And once you get to that place, then you've won. But we can't see that we're going to get there right away.
Right. No, I think that's a really great summary and a great outlook as well. Celebrate the wins.
If I was to, assuming everything kind of goes and meets expectations, some of this requires Congress and Senate and whatnot. I think that Trump is going to have massive victories domestically, and there's not going to be a whole lot of change foreign policy wise. I think we'll probably end up seeing the Ukraine stuff get cleaned up rather well. Middle East will kind of just continue going on business as usual. I would suspect, unless there's some sort of massive provocation somewhere, we're probably not going to go into any new wars. We'll end up seeing a lot of efficiency and cleanup in the military that makes just kind of the military overall better. The interventionism stuff, like, I don't expect massive changes to happen there. So yeah. but overall my expectations have been met. Like everything, I'm not really overly surprised by anything. All the things that I thought was going to be good are going to be good. All the things I thought were going to be milquetoast are milquetoast.
Yeah.
Right. Like, that's exactly where I'm at right
for
now.
For sure.
And I'm more positive than negative.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think we all agree on that.
Oh, another thing too is Trump, trued out. Specifically that Jamie Dimon will have no place in his administration, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
JP Morgan Chase,
CEO, yeah.
Who's massive lobbying efforts in DC, basically lives in DC full time.
And it was definitely angling for it. Yep. And you could tell by the media interviews. So we do have still people who haven't been placed yet from previous Trump administrations. So we're going to wait in the wings. We have Kash Patel. And that looks really interesting, right? And we can go there. And we saw the VA secretary. VA choice was a big win for Trump last time around. And I don't know if I have to describe that policy because we've done it before.
Yeah.
But and then lastly, I mean, I'm most excited about where we're going to go with this very important pick, which is the ambassador to Puerto Rico as Tony Hinchcliffe. I think it's a really important role that is yet to be filled.
Someone's got to clean up the floating island of trash, and it will be Tony Hinchcliffe.
Brought in record Puerto Rican votes.
Absolutely, yeah. You did.
So a couple of the other things I do want to talk about, if we can, I know we're going run a little bit long, is some of these other rationales, right? So like this is the Bolton rationale, right? You bring in Marco Rubio because he's a crazy person, right? Or you bring in Bolton because they're great, and then you get the compliance that you want. I don't know if that makes sense for Secretary of State in this case. I don't know if it makes sense for DOD pick because he's moving in a more restrained position in a lot of these things. But that said, having someone with a DOD background and things like that do give you credence to, like, we are willing to use force when appropriate.
Yeah.
These sort of like balancing acts and then compromises with the outside, you have to take as a given because the presidency isn't run the way we idealize it, right? It's run as a coalitional thing in order to maintain support and maintain a picture of American congruency over time to the outside world and then internally. You can't make huge changes really quickly. Not that I wouldn't say you should, I think you should, but it's very difficult to do so. So these are gains on the margin that people should appreciate.
Absolutely.
Something we kind of glossed over, the Kash Patel pick. He was one of the guys that I think everybody was expecting to go CIA director before Daniel Radcliffe came in.
John Radcliffe? We got Harry Potter as CIA director.
Daniel Radcliffe.
You can tell the episode's running along when Kyle recommends Harry Potter for CIA director.
Trump has officially started the Ministry of Magic.
It's the Ministry of Truth and Reconciliation. It's
the ministry. Expelliarmus.
Good luck getting back to your topic.
Radcliffe as FBI director, maybe.
John Radcliffe.
Yeah, no. As Kash Patel.
Oh, wow.
Kash Patel is somebody who's been a Trump loyalist and who's pretty solid, but he, I think a lot of people are angling for him for FBI director now.
Yes, and the way I understand that mechanism to work is Chris Wray would have to resign or be fired by Trump post-inauguration in order for Kash Patel to be appointed to that position. That's the way that one works. So that is why he hasn't been put into that spot yet. But I think that would be really, really interesting for him to get that spot. And a Ministry of Magic headed by Harry Potter would be fantastic too.
Maybe that's for the Department of Education role, as we kind of talk about maybe reinstituting Hogwarts into the system.
I think that makes total sense. Absolutely.
Corey, get on it.
I don't know. I don't know if it's going to be Corey. Yeah. we had things pointed out towards us.
Yeah,
well, that probably
perhaps.
Won't be the case.
Yeah, he retweeted us. He's a good guy.
He did. He is.
So one of the other arguments I heard is like you have to do these people because there's nobody else. Right. And this is an interesting component of it, because it does seem to me that there's like a knowledge gap amongst the general public of what the alternatives are. But we do have alternatives in these areas. It could have been better. So there's also, as much as I want to own the wins, there's also a side of like, yeah, there's plenty of people who could fulfill these roles that would be closer to, I think, Trump's vision. Additionally to the more realism and restraint vision that would be more consistent than Marco Rubio. For example, John Mearsheimer could have taken that role. Right. He is a diplomat.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Sachs in that role. John Mearsheimer, Colonel Douglas McGregor, William Ruger. He was the former ambassador to Afghanistan. He's with defense priorities. Christopher Miller. He's a former DOD. Not great on everything, but he's on publicly saying like you could do our U.S. military right now at 2008 levels and we'd be just as effective if you ran it right.
Yeah.
Like those sorts of things there are lots of people who could be taking these roles. So we also don't want to impoverish our standards and say that there was no one else.
Yeah.
Right? That is also a component of it. But maybe those people couldn't have been confirmed. So that's the other side of the calculus that we don't weigh, that they have to weigh, which is who will the Senate be able to confirm for these roles?
Yeah. Well, and I think that is the next step here, right? Is, okay, confirmation is coming. How does that process work? Obviously, John Thune, who's now Senate Majority Leader,
nothing.
Yeah. Okay.
But
whatever.
I was. I know I what you Bennett at. Was going to do it, and then he didn't.
You guys.
I smirked.
Bunch of children around here. Anyways, John Thune has explicitly stated if the Senate is resistant to appointing or to confirming any of these appointments, that recess appointments are on the table. And I was unclear what that even meant, so I did a little bit of digging on it. It appears that currently the Senate is particularly hostile to Matt Gaetz and Tulsi Gabbard. Mm-hmm. So those might be the ones that that they resist the most. A recess appointment.
Oh, we didn't even mention Matt Gaetz.
Was he early this week?
We didn't mention Matt Gaetz.
I don't think we've ever met. I don't think we've mentioned
him.
How
dare
any episode.
We?
Yeah,
he's going to be AG.
He's going to be AG, and that's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, not if John Bolton has his way.
This is true. Yeah. This is true. Well, we'll have to maybe circle back on that one, because how did we miss that? That's crazy. Really quickly, so the president's cabinet requires confirmation by the Senate. A recess appointment under Article 2, Section 2, Clause 3 of the Constitution is an alternative method of appointing officials that allows the temporary filling of offices during periods when the Senate is not in session. These days, this process is seemingly a little bit controversial. It's used as a political tool to temporarily install an unpopular nominee by sidestepping the Senate's role in the confirmation process. And really the way this works is it is temporary, but it seems as though under the way the rules work, these appointments can last for up to 2 years. So say the Senate is unfriendly to Matt Gaetz and John Thune is willing to play ball with Trump, He could recess the Senate, and then they could kind of just push through these appointments, get them in place at least for 2 years, at which point the Senate would actually have to vote. So that's the mechanism, the sort of like nuclear option, I think, in this case. If the Senate is unfriendly to some of these, Trump can make something happen.
We probably should mention one of the things that is, there's a lot of allegations that are being pointed towards Matt Gaetz and have been for a while around like sexual misconduct and sex trafficking.
Oh.
That they've been trying to do something about like a 17-year-old girl or something like that. I'm not too clear on all the stuff that's going. It seems very Kavanaugh-y. Mm-hmm. It seems like he's been he's been kind of just like battling off these like these allegations for a while now since he's been in, and it's just kind of like I think it's one of those things where he's really not liked amongst his peers because he's kind of one of the most Trump loyalists, but also like conservatively radical. He's one of the guys that was heavily involved in the speaker fight, all this stuff.
Yep.
Right. And we've seen this with a handful of congressmen before where they, you know, they speak out of line and all of a sudden it's just like, oh, hey, we heard that there's sex trafficking going on. You know, right. It's like, what?
Yeah. Yeah. So certainly there's been some talk from some of the neocon senators about really wanting to dig in on that stuff during the confirmation hearings. So we'll see.
What I see is, my prediction is, once this happens, once there's a recess appointment, there's going to be a big controversy about Trump being a dictator and all these things. I want to note ahead of time, recess confirmations go all the way back to George Washington.
Oh, for sure.
And the more political side of it, of like trying to get more controversial candidates and using it as like a naked political tool, that was done by Obama with the National Labor Relations Board members. So this is a common tool. It is controversial in the sense that, you know, ideally you have a more collaborative approach with the Senate. That said, these sorts of picks make sense, right? They're not the sort of things that you can say are completely out of the blue and are only controversial in the sense of the blob is so used to its hegemonic power, its ability to just determine what the outcomes are before they can even happen, that they're pissed off about it. So I could see, you know, especially if when it happens, the blowback from non-traditional media sources is substantial enough that these things could actually happen without a large recess, a 2-year-long recess appointment question.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I suppose it's just incumbent upon all of us who, and I think we've all noted it throughout the last couple of weeks, have been like very closely watching this. Like, I've never watched this process with so much intensity and interest, and I think that that's true of a lot of people. Like, I'm not sure that there's ever been a time where this has been such a public process where you know, X is just ablaze every time a new appointment is announced, and people are Googling, you know, who they are and looking up their background and retweeting clips of their statements and really understanding who these people are in this process.
Even the corporate press is giving more attention to this than any other time I've ever noticed, right? So even if you take out the variable social media, it's incredibly consequential for all the reasons that have been set up by the fact that Trump's last run was so undermined by his own picks and staff. So I think that's a big
one. A lot of these people that are getting selected have been the most interesting people in politics of the last few years.
True.
Right? Tulsi, RFK, Vivek, Elon, all of these people, they are kind of the center of attention. And it really is kind of this Trump bringing forward this Avengers team of all the political dissidents together.
Totally.
Under this new political realignment that we're seeing.
Yeah. It feels extremely consequential, and it's just fascinating. And I would encourage everybody to stay in tune, stay involved. And I mean, like, as the confirmation hearings start to happen, like, put pressure on your senators if they're speaking out against somebody you want to see appointed,
or the inverse.
Write them an email. Oh yeah, absolutely compliment and, you know, praise the behavior you want to see repeated.
You don't want to see Marco Rubio? Maybe he doesn't have to be the pick still.
Yeah, yeah, he can be fired, as we noted. Yeah. All right, guys. Well, hey, this has been a great show. Thank you for sticking around for this extended episode. Lots to cover. We really appreciate you. If you'd like to become a member of the show, support us, and get exclusive content, go to humanreactionpod.com. We'll be stepping into the SCIF next. And we'd love to have you join us for a deep dive on a very interesting figure by the name the moniker Mencius Mulbug.
Curtis Yarvin.
Curtis Yarvin.
He's kind of retired that name.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Well, you're the expert, not me.
I still like it.
It's fascinating. It's going to be a really great talk, and we look forward to seeing you there. Thanks a lot.
Yo, you did such a great job.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember...
About to go Avada Kedavra myself.